It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Children's Museum of Pittsburgh is taking the next step from repurposing an important part of Pittsburgh's past to be a valuable part of its present and future. Jane Werner is the executive director of the Children's Museum. Jane, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. So first, a little bit of the past, if you don't mind. The Children's Museum did start as a traveling museum, but it found its permanent home on the north side in 1983.
Yeah, it's our 35th year. And we actually were founded by the Junior League, and we were founded in the basement of the old post office building on the north side of Pittsburgh.
Why the basement?
Actually,
was the post office still functioning?
Pittsburgh History and Landmarks had taken over the building. So they had the rest of the building, and there was a post office museum in it. And Pittsburgh History and Landmarks had kind of traditional historic exhibits in it. So oddly, we were in the basement. And then in the late 1980s, they moved to the second floor, leaving the first floor for Pittsburgh History and Landmarks. And then eventually in the 90s, they took over the entire building. We took over the entire building.
Yeah. It's we now, not they.
I know. I've been there long enough. I shouldn't make that mistake.
And then the expansion came. You saw a need. What was it that led to the expansion and repurposing the old Buell building?
So it was interesting. In the 90s, we actually did an exhibit with Fred Rogers. And it was an exhibit that I worked on with Fred. And it was called Welcome to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And during the six-month run of that exhibit at the museum, we saw the same amount of people. We saw 83,000 people. And we had seen 83,000 people the year before for the entire year. So we knew that we could actually, we knew we had an audience. And we knew we could grow that audience. And that's kind of how we started to look at the Buell Science Center at the time. It had been vacant, the old Buell Planetarium.
Right.
And we decided to look at expanding at that point.
All right. But what did it allow you to do? More programs? I mean, fit in more people at any one time? You alluded to the numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always had dreams of really having a big impact. And now we see over 300,000 people a year. Which I like to argue we're the second most visited museum in Pittsburgh because the Carnegies in Oakland have to actually split their numbers. I'm not sure they see it that way, but that's the way
we
see
it. A little museum competition. You know,
hey,
here.
It's healthy.
Okay. Now let's talk about your plans for yet another nearby building, the former Carnegie Library, Allegheny. Wasn't that one of Andrew Carnegie's first free libraries?
Well, we understand that it was the first library commissioned, not the first one opened, but the first one commissioned. We also understand that it was actually a model for the Oakland branch. And if you look at the building, you can kind of see the echoes of, you know, of both buildings. And it has been vacant since 2007. I think it was 2007. Mm-hmm. Lightning struck the tower of it.
Yes.
And this huge piece of granite came flying through the roof, hit all of the mechanicals and even a baby grand piano. Yeah. And the library decided to build their beautiful branch up the street.
Right. That was a major news story at that time, that lightning strike.
Yeah.
So now this expansion is not just to, you know, accommodate more people, but it is more people, but a different age group, because your current programs are really focused on tiny ones to age 10.
Well, actually, because Fred Rogers was my mentor, I actually never say the ages.
Okay.
Because I think kids are at all different ages when they come to the museum.
Okay.
And usually they can find their way. But it is, you know, if I have to really be truthful with myself, our age group is around, you know, four, five, six. Really, that's where the majority of the kids come. But we are seeing an increase ever since we put our maker space in. Kids ages 8 and above, we've actually seen a 30% increase. So we decided to kind of create a space for older kids and kind of a separate brand, separate building, everything. And we're calling it Museum Lab. And even though it's associated with the Children's Museum, it's completely a place for older kids.
Okay. So right now, I want to talk more about the Museum Lab and the programs that you have in mind. But right now, for somebody who doesn't know, has not been to the Children's Museum, they enter and what does they see?
Well, first of all, they see a beautiful building. We really are committed to design. We think kids can appreciate good design as well as adults, so everybody feels comfortable. They'll find different areas to really explore different art making. We have a studio where you can do silk screening, you can do painting, clay, and actually this past weekend they were doing crazy things where dancers were using art materials to dance within paint. It was quite extraordinary and quite beautiful. We have a maker space where you can actually do 3D printing or laser cutting or just even explore circuits. There's a climber, there's a water play, which is I think the favorite for almost everybody, except maybe parents. And there's the garage where you can explore all different kinds of things. And we have a very exciting exhibit right now that we produced in-house that'll be traveling the country, The Art of Rube Goldberg. And we created Rube Goldberg machines, which are fantastic. Our team did a terrific job. Highly recommend for adults as well as children, children as well as adults. Okay. Really, it's a great exhibit.
Okay, now let's talk more about Museum Lab, because that's what we're looking forward to really coming to fruition in the next about 6 months, I guess. So this is intended for age 10 and up. Is it because you have these children who said, well, geez, I had so much fun in the Children's Museum, but, you know, maybe I'm a little old for that now. What do you have for me now? And the second part of the question is, how did you assess maybe what they wanted, what they needed?
So it's the too cool for school kind of thing. Yeah, we actually know that it's really tough to walk through our doors when you're 10. Because I don't think you consider yourself a child anymore, which is a sad statement in a lot of ways. But we also realized that when 10-year-olds would come with their younger siblings, they were having a blast. Mm-hmm. Like they were really having a great time. So how do you actually capture that? And how do you actually think about older kids by creating a space for them? You know, we can then really think about education and we can think about this through line from early childhood all the way through adulthood. If we can kind of get to older kids and then have our teenage volunteer program, you can actually see how you can create lifelong learners. We have actually involved kids and older children all along the planning of this. We actually have an advisory council, which has been really a blast. We're actually working with Kappa Kids right now to talk about doing the social media, because I do not have Snapchat on my phone. I don't know about you.
Nope.
Yeah. Nope. So okay. we're really kind of involving older kids in the whole conversation about what this space could be.
We don't have time for it all, but I want to talk about some highlights. There will be some physical climbing in the Museum Lab. How's this coming about?
Well, in one portion of the building, we could not take out the stacks, so we had to...
Stacks from the library.
The library, that's right. So they were structural to the building. And our design team found this amazing artist from Slovenia who creates climbing structures using traditional lace-making techniques.
Hmm. And what's this look like?
Like big doilies. Yeah, they really are. They're like, it's going to be three stories of big doilies that you climb on. I know that sounds odd, but it's actually quite stunning, quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. And the climb will be challenging. It's not going to be easy. So your four-year-old, you know, brother or sister will not be able to come in the climber if you're 10 with you. So we kind of think that that's good. Everybody can climb over at our place. They don't. The right. Older kids are really going to be at Museum Lab.
Is there a metaphor here, too, that I mean, not only physically climbing, but sort of climbing and they're learning at the other parts of Museum Lab?
Yeah, it's actually it's called a lab for a reason, because it's all about experimentation. So we'll be partnering with Carnegie Mellon University, especially in Tech Lab and in Studio Lab. In Tech Lab, the Entertainment Technology Center will be showing off some of their technology of what they're thinking about for gaming or for they have this great VR goggles that you can put on and and draw in 3D space, that kind of thing. We will have a something called Make Lab with a little bit more sophisticated maker activities. So it's called a lab because it will constantly be changing.
Right. We have just a couple minutes left. How do you determine what to include to help kids learn? Is it through this advisory sort of committee? And also to make the learning fun?
Well, it's, you know, we are unusual in the museum business because we have an amazing team of people who prototype things before they actually go on the floor. So we prototype, and then we have a Department of Learning and Research, which actually studies what happens. So we kind of know what's going to happen before anything gets built permanently. Mm-hmm. It's an exciting time.
Okay. I have just about a minute. And I read a quote from you that when it's finished, Museum Lab will be the largest cultural campus for children in the country. What do you mean by that? What do you want from that?
Well, first of all, I think it's a really great symbol of Pittsburgh's care for their kids and for their children. And what we mean by that is that we have these four buildings that have now been strung together, and it's for children. And all of the people, we have partners in this project, from Carnegie Mellon to the University of Pittsburgh to Saturday Light Brigade to Reading is Fundamental, Allies for Children. We're all kind of coming together with Manchester Academic Charter School to really show how kids learn and to show all the things that we can do kind of in an experimental mode to make things, to maybe push education a little bit further.
You mentioned 35 years at the beginning of our conversation. What's your hope for the next generation of kids in the Children's Museum?
We actually hope to change education by actually doing these small experiments in an informal world of the museum and then apply them to the formal classroom. So we're really hoping that we think differently about education.
Jane Werner is Executive Director of the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh. Jane, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Denora Smog Museum opens in Denora, Pennsylvania in 2008. The museum showcases artifacts from the 1948 abnormal atmospheric incident known as the Denora Smog. The event killed 20 people and made about 7,000 sick. The fog was caused by the combination of emissions from a nearby steel plant and a severe temperature inversion, trapping the pollutants in a layer of fog. The lawsuits and health effects after the event are often credited with influencing policy like the Clean Air Act. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for October 15th, 2018.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today we meet Vanessa German, a Homewood-based artist who has dedicated her life to using her talents and art to lift up her community. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports.
The poem with my hand on a door of a room marked infinite possibility.
There is power in art.
Vanessa German's passion is rooted in her imagination, which has led her to build elaborate sculptures and write and perform stage plays. It's also been the vehicle she's used to help ensure the tools of creativity are accessible to the residents in her community. She says she began creating art by using materials she found during her travels.
And one of the ways that I did that was pick up stuff out of vacant lots and from the front porches of vacant houses. And I would take this wood and take these keys and bottle caps and old glass bottles that I would find, and I would stack them and move them around a certain way in my studio. And the act of moving the materials around and transforming them did something to my mind.
Having struggled with depression, German attempted suicide numerous times and found that art was her way to cope with the realities of life. She attributes her ability to carry on as the catalyst for her artistic prowess.
I decided, instead of ending my life, to sort of think about my life scientifically for 6 months and see if I could tap into the power of love.
A place she calls the Art House sits on Hamilton Avenue in Homewood. Outside is draped with mosaic decorations. Inside are paintings, rooms filled with decorated chairs, bookcases, and walls. Handmade, African-inspired statues of powerful women stand tall, telling the story of what German says is the pain endured by generations of oppression.
I think of it as like a handed down sorrow, that my grandmother felt a little bit of this and her grandmother felt a little bit of this. It is connected to like the rupture that African people experienced, being ruptured from your land. And when you're ruptured from your land, you're ruptured from the seeds that your people sowed in the ground to nourish your body.
Children from the neighborhood are welcome to enter the house when the doors are open and encouraged to use art supplies to create anything that suits their imagination. German's talents aren't limited to the realm of visual arts. She won acclaim for her performance in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, written by Pittsburgh-born playwright August Wilson. Stage play director Mark Clayton Southers says German's talent is unmatched worldwide.
She's the type of person that I like to call a DIAP, a do-it-all person. She knows she has a gift.
Southers says despite German's work being featured in museums around the world, he's pleased to know that she has no plans of leaving Western Pennsylvania.
She can go overseas and become a phenom, but it's great that she decided to stay in Homewood.
German says her motivation to create is not to produce art for art's sake, but rather she sees her art as an expression of love and opportunity to pay it forward.
There's power in love. Love has literally saved my life. I am going to share it with other people because I believe in this power.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence. I'm Megan Harris. City employees may soon have to pony up if they continue to light up. The Pittsburgh Tribune Review's Bob Bowder is with us in studio to explain a new fee policy that could affect about one-third of the city's 3,000 employees. Bob, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
So, Bob, tell us about this tobacco fee.
Okay. In 2017, the city announced that it was going to impose a tobacco fee on employees who smoke or use smokeless tobacco, and the money will go toward paying health care premiums for these employees.
Those premiums will be $50 each. Who exactly will this affect?
The employees that are affected are about 1,000 workers that are non-union and members of two unions, the AFSCME and SEIU unions.
Those union jobs, what kinds of positions are we talking about?
People like managers, supervisors who are not in unions, and clerks, people who work in offices for, say, like the Department of Public Works, mainly clerical.
Was this broached with city employees or the various unions before that fee was imposed?
Well, the city says it was, that they informed the employees, and they have had 15 months now to, you know, either they have two choices. They can either quit or enter into a tobacco cessation program that the city provides free to all employees.
So how are the employees themselves taking this?
Well, they're not very happy. I talked to several employees, more than several. I've talked to a dozen or so that use tobacco, and they're calling it a tax. They say it's discriminatory. They say that, and they ask, where does this end? It's a slippery slope, okay? Will the city next impose a fee for people who are obese or people who have risky health behaviors?
How does the city know whether an employee smokes?
Well, the employees are required to sign an affidavit saying whether or not they smoke. And the city's calling it a legally binding affidavit.
Are they doing that, self-reporting in that way?
Yes, as far as I know, they are. I've talked to several employees that have done it.
Are they worried about that now?
Well, they have to pay the fee. You know, they're going to smoke and or you chew or whatever they do, and they'll pay the $50.
So is there any recourse for the people who just categorically object to this?
No. But I will say that I've talked to the AFSCME union, and they say that they have not agreed to this. They say it's part of collective bargaining, that it's an issue, that it's a workplace issue, and it has to be negotiated through collective bargaining. So there's a little bit of a dispute there between the city and the union. They have a meeting where they're going to talk about it, but the city says that these two unions have agreed to it, but at least one of the unions say they have not.
And it sounds like they've got a friend in the ACLU.
Well, the ACLU has characterized this as lifestyle discrimination. Basically, that's their position.
So what are the next steps?
Well, the next steps apparently are going to be a meeting Tuesday between the union and or the union and the city, but non-union employees are going to have to start paying the fee starting January 1st.
Bob Bowder is the City Hall reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Bob, great to see you again.
Hey, thanks for having me, Megan.
That meeting between AFSCME Local 2719 and the city's law department is scheduled for tomorrow. I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last season for the Steelers was filled with distractions on the field and off, from trade demands to what to do during the national anthem. This season, so far, maybe not so many, but still enough distractions that could steal some focus from the players. Joining us in studio, Sean Gentile, sports writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
Kevin, good to see you again, man.
All right, Sean, I didn't realize that anyone wanted to renew the Steelers soap opera for another season. Did you?
I did not, but I also didn't ask Antonio Brown before the start. So,
are you a good news or a bad news first kind of guy?
I'm always good news first.
All right, so let's start with the positive. I would say the most positive thing that's happened to the Steelers in the last 10 months was the energy, the smiles, even the tears when Steeler linebacker Ryan Shazier yesterday walked onto the field that he was carried off of last December with a severe spinal cord injury.
Absolutely. I mean, that feels like it happened 10 years ago at this point, right? It seemed like it happened so long ago, but it was good to see Shazier. You know, he gets better by the day too, by the way, as far as his stride, the way he's walking, just yesterday compared to the going across the stage at the draft,
right.
You know, it's been a lot of progress with him, and you know, you factor in that it did happen in Cincinnati, which is where the injury happened in the first place. Yeah, that's an undeniably positive thing, and it's a positive turn for what looked to be a tragic situation, and still on some level is, but it's tracking about as well as it could.
Right. So he's inspiring his teammates emotionally, but also in a sense in a teaching mode. He's coaching up the linebackers too, isn't he?
Yeah. It's easy to forget that part of his game particularly, I think. He called the defensive signals, and he was, you know, the quarterback of the defense from that inside linebacker position. So he was important from a thinking the game standpoint, and from the standpoint of getting those guys in position to do what they have to do. And you know, a big part of his job is, you know, watching tape and getting them prepped and getting them ready for the next week's opponent. So yeah, he's an important part of the on the field stuff too.
One more thing about Ryan Shazier. Anybody that knows him wouldn't be surprised by this. Saturday, he visited the hospital, University of Cincinnati Medical Center, to thank the people, because that's where he was treated for the first couple of days following that severe injury.
Absolutely, and without fail, really from the start. Whether it was his family, whether it was, you know, the first time we heard from him, whether it was in statements released by the team, you know, he consistently has thanked the University of Cincinnati Medical Department and those doctors there and the surgeons there for the care that he received. So yeah, that's directly in line with the way he's approached from the start. You know, he's very grateful to that crew of people, and I think he showed it again yesterday.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this. It would have been a downer after all that if the Steelers had lost to Cincinnati, but they pulled out 28-21 win, which really shouldn't be surprising because they do that all the time, really, against the Bengals.
Yeah, that's what the Bengals do. I think on a lot of levels you saw that from them again. They find ways to lose to the Steelers, and especially at home. So yeah, you have that late touchdown by Joe Mixon, and I think they forgot how much time was left on the clock, honestly. So they found a way to choke it away again, and I think the Steelers found a way to pull it out.
All right. So they go into a bye week, a week off. Their record is 3-2-1. Cincinnati is now 4-2. Baltimore is also up there. So that's the positive, the
right
win. Let's go to the bad news, the negative now. Antonio Brown earlier in the season was upset with the numbers of catches and yardage. He and Ben weren't clicking. Ben Roethlisberger weren't clicking. Now there's a significant off-the-field issue for Brown. He's being sued for allegedly throwing furniture from the 14th floor balcony of a Florida luxury apartment complex in April. What's all this about?
Oh boy! So
yeah, a lot of people
right,
are saying that.
So the root of the start of his what's a set of civil suits is legal issues there that he couldn't find $80,000 in the gun and he said were taken from his apartment, said that essentially accused the security department of his apartment building for taking it, and then one way or another, an ottoman and a frame and some other assorted
vase
detritus ended up on the ground. So, the suit against him says that he threw it. His defense, which his attorneys released in a filing a few days ago, says essentially it wasn't me, and you can't prove it was me. So that's sort of where we are right now. He's got that suit, which he had to respond to by last week. He's also got another civil suit filed against him by the landlord and by the property management company. So that one, we're not quite as far down the road in the legal process with that as we are with a complaint from the co-tenant. But that hasn't gone away yet, and I think we're gonna see that continue to hang around in some form.
Yeah, I believe a man said that his 22-month-old child was there with the child's grandfather nearby where the stuff came crashing.
Absolutely,
down.
And it's a luxury apartment complex. This is a hedge fund manager and a commercial real estate developer who's alleging that Brown threw that stuff from the 14th floor down to the pool. So we'll see, but yeah, I think. They did their best to defuse at least that half of it last night or last week, saying, I didn't do it. You can't prove it was me.
Wasn't me. This,
yeah, exactly. It was the Shaggy defense. It wasn't me. I wasn't expecting to hear that from Antonio Brown, but no, it was interesting.
All right, just about a minute left. I mentioned this is a bye week. Le'Veon Bell, all pro running back, hasn't signed his $14 million contract, has been losing about $850K every week for not signing. Could come in this week or next, but we've been saying that for weeks.
Yeah.
So what kind of a distraction has this been?
I think a fairly minimal one. I think part of the reason that helps is because James Conner's been good. I think if they weren't getting that production from him, then the questions would be a lot more intense. But I don't think it's been quite as much of an issue as people would guess.
All right. Even though there was some tension, his linemen were saying, "Who cares?" Basically.
That's one of those things. They caught him at a tough moment. They caught him right when they realized he wasn't showing up, and they were over it an hour and a half later.
All right, Sean, 15 seconds. Will the Steelers be able to put aside these distractions, make the playoffs, and if so, make any progress in the playoffs?
I think coming out of the bye week is really important. They have two more divisional games, and that's gonna set them up moving forward. But I certainly think they can.
3-2-1 right now. Prediction record at the end of the season. We know there'll be at least one tie.
Yeah, right. Well, I'll still go 10-5-1. I think they're lined up for that.
Sean Gentile, a sports writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Sean, thanks so much.
Certainly, Kevin.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, we'll look at key recommendations from the Pennsylvania Blue Ribbon Commission on Pennsylvania's election security. Plus, the U.S. Supreme Court is at full complement now. Some of the cases the justices are hearing are of particular interest to Pennsylvania. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.